Chapter 7 The Pendragon 1 Before she reached the door in the wall, Jane met Mr. Denniston, and he guided her into the manor, not by that door, but by the main gate, which opened on the same road a few hundred yards further on. She told him her story as they walked. In his company she had that curious sensation which most married people know of being with someone whom, for the final but wholly mysterious reason, one could never have married, but who is, nevertheless, more of one's own world than the person one has married, in fact. As they entered the house, they met Mrs. Maggs.
"What? Mrs. Studdock? Fancy," said Mrs. Maggs.
"Yes, Ivy," said Denniston, "and bringing great news. Things are beginning to move. We must see Grace at once. And is McPhee about?"
"Oh, he's out gardening hours ago," said Mrs. Maggs,
"and Dr. Dimble's gone into college, and Camilla's in the kitchen. Shall I send her along?"
"Yes, do. And if you can prevent Mr. Bultitude from butting in."
"Oh, that's right. I'll keep him out of mischief, all right. You'd like a cup of tea, Mrs. Studdock, wouldn't you? Come in by train and all that."
A few minutes later, Jane found herself once more in Grace Ironwood's room. Miss Ironwood and the Dennistons all sat facing her, so that she felt as if she were the candidate in a viva voce examination. And when Ivy Maggs brought in the tea, she did not go away again, but sat down, as if she also were one of the examiners.
"Now," said Camilla, her eyes and nostrils widening with a sort of fresh mental hunger. It was too concentrated to be called excitement. Jane glanced round the room.
"You need not mind Ivy, young lady," said Miss Ironwood. "She is one of our company." There was a pause. "We have your letter of the 10th," continued Miss Ironwood, "describing your dream of the man with the pointed beard sitting making notes in your bedroom. Perhaps I ought to tell you that he wasn't really there, at least the director does not think it possible. But he was really studying you. He was getting information about you from some other source, which, unfortunately, was not visible to you in the dream."
"Will you tell us, if you don't mind," said Mr. Denniston, "what you were telling me as we came along?"
Jane told them about the dream of the corpse, if it was a corpse, in the dark place, and how she had met the bearded man that morning in Market Street, and at once she was aware of having created intense interest.
"Fancy," said Ivy Maggs.
"So we were right about Bragdon Wood," said Camilla.
"It is really Belbury," said her husband.
"But in that case, where does Alcassan come in?"
"Excuse me," said Miss Ironwood in her level voice, and the others became instantly silent. "We must not discuss the matter here. Mrs. Studdock has not yet joined us."
"Am I to be told nothing?" asked Jane.
"Young lady," said Miss Ironwood, "you must excuse me. It would not be wise at the moment. Indeed, we are not at liberty to do so. Will you allow me to ask you two more questions?"
"If you like," said Jane, a little sulkily, but only a very little. The presence of Camilla and Camilla's husband somehow put her on her best behaviour.
Miss Ironwood had opened a drawer, and for a few moments there was silence while she hunted in it. Then she handed a photograph across to Jane and asked, "Do you recognise that person?"
"Yes," said Jane in a low voice. "That is the man I dreamed of, and the man I saw this morning in Edgestow."
It was a good photograph, and beneath it was the name Augustus Frost, with a few other details which Jane did not at the moment take in.
"In the second place," continued Miss Ironwood, holding out her hand for Jane to return the photograph, "are you prepared to see the director now?"
"Well, yes, if you like."
"In that case, Arthur," said Miss Ironwood to Denniston, "you had better go and tell him what we have just heard, and find out if he is well enough to meet Mrs. Studdock."
Denniston rose at once.
"In the meantime," said Miss Ironwood, "I would like a word with Mrs. Studdock alone."
At this the others rose also and preceded Denniston out of the room. A very large cat, which Jane had not noticed before, jumped up and occupied the chair which Ivy Maggs had just vacated.
"I have very little doubt," said Miss Ironwood, "that the director will see you."
Jane said nothing.
"And at that interview," continued the other, "you will, I presume, be called upon to make a final decision."
Jane gave a little cough, which had no other purpose than to dispel a certain air of unwelcome solemnity which seemed to have settled on the room as soon as she and Miss Ironwood were left alone.
"There are also certain things," said Miss Ironwood, "which you ought to know about the director before you see him.
He will appear to you, Mrs. Sturrock, to be a very young man, younger than yourself. You will please understand that this is not the case. He is nearer 50 than 40. He is a man of very great experience, who has travelled where no other human being ever travelled before, and mixed in societies of which you and I have no conception. "Well, that is very interesting," said Jane, though displaying no interest. "And thirdly," said Miss Ironwood, "I must ask you to remember that he is often in great pain. Whatever decision you come to, I trust you will not say or do anything that may put an unnecessary strain upon him." "If Mr. Fisher King is not well enough to see visitors," said Jane vaguely. "You must excuse me," said Miss Ironwood, "for impressing these points upon you. I am a doctor, and I am the only doctor in our company. I am therefore responsible for protecting him as far as I can. If you will now come with me, I will show you to the blue room." She rose and held the door open for Jane. They passed out into the plain, narrow passage, and thence up shallow steps into a large entrance hall, whence a fine Georgian staircase led to the upper floors. The house, larger than Jane had at first supposed, was warm and very silent, and after so many days spent in fog, the autumn sunlight, falling on soft carpets and on walls, seemed to her bright and golden. On the first floor, but raised above it by 6 steps, they found a little square place with white pillars, where Camilla, quiet and alert, sat waiting for them. There was a door behind her. "He will see her," she said to Miss Ironwood, getting up. "Is he in much pain this morning?" "It is not continuous. It is one of his good days." As Miss Ironwood raised her hand to knock on the door, Jane thought to herself, "Be careful. Don't get let in for anything. All these long passages and low voices will make a fool of you if you don't look out. You'll become another of this man's female adorers." Next moment she found herself going in. It was light. It seemed all windows. And it was warm. A fire blazed on the hearth. And blue was the prevailing colour. Before her eyes had taken it in, she was annoyed, and in a way ashamed, to see that Miss Ironwood was curtsying. "I won't," contended in Jane's mind with, "I can't," for it had been true in her dream she couldn't. "This is the young lady, sir," said Miss Ironwood. Jane looked, and instantly her world was unmade. On a sofa before her, with one foot bandaged as if he had a wound, lay what appeared to be a boy, 20 years old. On one of the long window sills, a tame jackdaw was walking up and down. The light of the fire with its weak reflection, and the light of the sun with its stronger reflection, contended on the ceiling. But all the light in the room seemed to run towards the gold hair and the gold beard of the wounded man. Of course he was not a boy. How could she have thought so? The fresh skin on his forehead and cheeks, and, above all, on his hands, had suggested the idea. But no boy could have so full a beard, and no boy could be so strong. She had expected to see an invalid. Now it was manifest that the grip of those hands would be inescapable, and imagination suggested that those arms and shoulders could support the whole house. Miss Ironwood at her side struck her as a little old woman, shrivelled and pale, a thing you could have blown away. The sofa was placed on a kind of dais, divided from the rest of the room by a step. She had an impression of massed hangings of blue. Later she saw that it was only a screen, behind the man, so that the effect was that of a throne room. She would have called it silly if, instead of seeing it, she had been told of it by another. Through the window she saw no trees, nor hills, nor shapes of other houses, only the level floor of mist, as if this man and she were perched in a blue tower overlooking the world. Pain came and went in his face, sudden jabs of sickening and burning pain. But as lightning goes through the darkness, and the darkness closes up again and shows no trace, so the tranquillity of his countenance swallowed up each shock of torture. How could she have thought him young, or old either? It came over her with a sensation of quick fear that this face was of no age at all. She had, or so she had believed, disliked bearded faces except for old men with white hair. But that was because she had long since forgotten the imagined Arthur of her childhood, and the imagined Solomon, too. Solomon. For the first time in many years the bright solar blend of king and lover and magician, which hangs about that name, stole back upon her mind. For the first time in all those years she tasted the word king itself, with all linked associations of battle, marriage, priesthood, mercy, and power. At that moment, as her eyes first rested on his face, Jane forgot who she was and where, and her faint grudge against Grace Ironwood, and her more obscure grudge against Mark, and her childhood, and her father's house. It was, of course, only for a flash. Next moment she was once more the ordinary social Jane, flushed and confused to find that she had been staring rudely. At least she hoped that rudeness would be the main impression produced at a total stranger. But her world was unmade, she knew that. Anything might happen now. "Thank you, Grace," the man was saying. "Is this Mrs. Studdock?" And the voice also seemed to be like sunlight and gold. Like gold not only as gold is beautiful, but as it is heavy. Like sunlight not only as it falls gently on English walls in autumn, but as it beats down on the jungle or the desert to engender life or destroy it. And now it was addressing her. "You must forgive me for not getting up, Mrs. Studdock," it said. "My foot is hurt." And Jane heard her own voice saying, "Yes, sir," soft and chastened like Miss Ironwood's voice. She had meant to say, "Good morning, Mr. Fisher King," in an easy tone that would have counteracted the absurdity of her behaviour on first entering the room. But the other was what actually came out of her mouth. Shortly after this she found herself seated before the director. She was shaken. She was even shaking. She hoped intensely that she was not going to cry, or be unable to speak, or do anything silly. For her world was unmade. Anything might happen now. If only the conversation were over, so that she could get out of that room without disgrace, and go away, not for good, but for a long time. "Do you wish me to remain, sir?" said Miss Ironwood. "No, Grace," said the director. "I don't think you need stay. Thank you." And now, thought Jane, it's coming. It's coming. It's coming now. All the most intolerable questions he might ask, all the most extravagant things he might make her do, flashed through her mind in a fatuous medley. For all power of resistance seemed to have been drained away from her, and she was left without protection. 2. For the first few minutes after Grace Ironwood had left them alone, Jane hardly took in what the director was saying. It was not that her attention wandered. On the contrary, her attention was so fixed on him that it defeated itself. Every tone, every look, how could they have supposed she would think him young? Every gesture was printing itself upon her memory. And it was not until she found that he had ceased speaking and was apparently awaiting an answer that she realized she had taken in so little of what he had been saying.
I beg your pardon," she said, wishing that she did not keep on turning red like a schoolgirl.
"I was saying," he answered, "that you have already done us the greatest possible service. We knew that one of the most dangerous attacks ever made upon the human race was coming very soon, and in this island. We had an idea that Belbury might be connected with it, but we were not certain. We certainly did not know that Belbury was so important. That is why your information is so valuable. But in another way, it presents us with a difficulty. I mean a difficulty as far as you are concerned. We had hoped you would be able to join us, to become one of our army."
"Can I not, sir?" said Jane.
"It is difficult," said the director after a pause. "You see, your husband is in Belbury." Jane glanced up. It had been on the tip of her tongue to say, "Do you mean that Mark is in any danger?" But she had realized that anxiety about Mark did not, in fact, make any part of the complex emotions she was feeling, and that to reply thus would be hypocrisy. It was a sort of scruple she had not often felt before. Finally she said, "What do you mean?" "Why," said the director, "it would be hard for the same person to be the wife of an official in the NICE and also a member of my company."
"You mean you couldn't trust me?"
"I mean nothing we need be afraid to speak of. I mean that in the circumstances you and I and your husband could not all be trusting one another." Jane bit her lip in anger, not at the director, but at Mark. Why should he and his affairs with the Featherstone man intrude themselves at such a moment as this?
"I must do what I think right, mustn't I?" she said softly. "I mean, if my husband is on the wrong side, I can't let that make any difference to what I do, can I?"
"You are thinking about what is right?" said the director. Jane started and flushed. She had not, she realized, been thinking about that.
Of course, said the director, things might come to such a point that you would be justified in coming here, even wholly against his will, even secretly. It depends on how close the danger is, the danger to us all, and to you personally.
I thought the danger was right on top of us now, from the way Mrs. Denniston talked.
That is just the question, said the director with a smile. I am not allowed to be too prudent. I am not allowed to use desperate remedies until desperate diseases are really apparent. Otherwise we become just like our enemies, breaking all the rules whenever we imagine that it might possibly do some vague good to humanity in the remote future.
But will it do anyone any harm if I come here? Asked Jane.
He did not directly answer this. Presently he spoke again. It looks as if you will have to go back, at least for the present. You will, no doubt, be seeing your husband again fairly soon. I think you must make at least one effort to detach him from the NICE.
But how can I, sir? Said Jane. What have I to say to him? He'd think it all nonsense. He wouldn't believe all that about an attack on the human race.
As soon as she had said it, she wondered, did that sound cunning? Then, more disconcertingly, was it cunning?
No, said the director, and you must not tell him. You must not mention me nor the company at all. We have put our lives in your hands. You must simply ask him to leave Belbury. You must put it on your own wishes. You are his wife.
Mark never takes any notice of what I say, answered Jane. She and Mark each thought that of the other.
Perhaps, said the director, you have never asked anything as you will be able to ask this. Do you not want to save him as well as yourself?
Jane ignored this question. Now that the threat of expulsion from the house was imminent, she felt a kind of desperation. Heedless of that inner commentator who had more than once during this conversation shown her own words and wishes in such a novel light, she began speaking rapidly.
"Don't send me back," she said. "I am all alone at home with terrible dreams. It isn't as if Mark and I saw much of one another at the best of times. I'm so unhappy. He won't care whether I come here or not. He'd only laugh at it all if he knew. Is it fair that my whole life should be spoiled just because he's got mixed up with some horrible people? You don't think a woman is to have no life of her own just because she's married?"
"Are you unhappy now?" said the director. A dozen affirmatives died on Jane's lips as she looked up in answer to his question. Then suddenly, in a kind of deep calm, like the stillness at the centre of a whirlpool, she saw the truth, and ceased at last to think how her words might make him think of her, and answered, "No."
"But," she added after a short pause, "it will be worse now if I go back."
"Will it?"
"I don't know. No, I suppose not."
And for a little time Jane was hardly conscious of anything but peace and well-being, the comfort of her own body in the chair where she sat, and a sort of clear beauty in the colours and proportions of the room. But soon she began thinking to herself, "This is the end. In a moment he will send for the Ironwood woman to take you away." It seemed to her that her fate depended on what she said in the next minute.
"But is it really necessary?" she began. "I don't think I look on marriage quite as you do. It seems to me extraordinary that everything should hang on what Mark says, about something he doesn't understand."
"Child," said the director, "it is not a question of how you or I look on marriage, but how my masters look on it.
Someone said they were very old-fashioned, but
that was a joke. They are not old-fashioned, but they are very, very old.
They would never think of finding out first whether Mark and I believed in their ideas of marriage?"
"Well, no," said the director with a curious smile. "No, quite definitely they wouldn't think of doing that."
"And it would make no difference to them what a marriage was actually like, whether it was a success, whether the woman loved her husband?"
Jane had not exactly intended to say this, much less to say it in the cheaply pathetic tone which, it now seemed to her, she had used. Hating herself and fearing the director's silence, she added, "But I suppose you will say I oughtn't to have told you that."
"My dear child," said the director, "you have been telling me that ever since your husband was mentioned."
"Does it make no difference?"
"I suppose," said the director, "it would depend on how he lost your love."
Jane was silent. Though she could not tell the director the truth, and indeed did not know it herself,
Yet when she tried to explore her inarticulate grievance against Mark, a novel sense of her own injustice and even of pity for her husband arose in her mind. And her heart sank, for now it seemed to her that this conversation, to which she had vaguely looked for some sort of deliverance from all problems, was, in fact, involving her in new ones. "It was not his fault," she said at last. "I suppose our marriage was just a mistake." The director said nothing. What would the people you are talking of say about a case like that?" "I will tell you if you really want to know," said the director. "Please," said Jane reluctantly. "They would say," he answered, "that you do not fail in obedience through lack of love, but have lost love because you never attempted obedience." Something in Jane that would normally have reacted to such a remark with anger or laughter was banished to a remote distance, where she could still, but only just, hear its voice, by the fact that the word obedience, but certainly not obedience to Mark, came over her in that room and in that presence like a strange oriental perfume, perilous, seductive, and ambiguous. "Stop it," said the director sharply. Jane stared at him open-mouthed. There were a few moments of silence during which the exotic fragrance faded away. "You were saying, my dear," resumed the director. "I thought love meant equality," she said, "and free companionship." "Ah, equality," said the director. "We must talk of that some other time. Yes, we must all be guarded by equal rights from one another's greed because we are fallen, just as we must all wear clothes for the same reason. But the naked body should be there underneath the clothes, ripening for the day when we shall need them no longer. Equality is not the deepest thing, you know." "I always thought that was just what it was. I thought it was in their souls that people were equal." "You were mistaken," said he gravely. "That is the last place where they are equal. Equality before the law, equality of incomes, that is very well. Equality guards life. It doesn't make it. It is medicine, not food. You might as well try to warm yourself with a blue book." "But surely in marriage—" "Worse and worse," said the director. "Courtship knows nothing of it, nor does fruition. What has free companionship to do with that? Those who are enjoying something or suffering something together are companions. Those who enjoy or suffer one another are not. Do you not know how bashful friendship is? Friends, comrades, do not look at each other. Friendship would be ashamed." "I thought," said Jane, and stopped. "I see," said the director. "It is not your fault. They never warned you. No one has ever told you that obedience, humility, is an erotic necessity. You are putting equality just where it ought not to be. As to your coming here, that may admit of some doubt. For the present, I must send you back. You can come out and see us. In the meantime, talk to your husband, and I will talk to my authorities." "When will you be seeing them?" "They come to me when they please. But we've been talking too solemnly about obedience all this time. I'd like to show you some of its drolleries. You are not afraid of mice, are you?"
"Afraid of what?" said Jane in astonishment.
"Mice," said the director.
"No," said Jane in a puzzled voice.
The director struck a little bell beside his sofa, which was almost immediately answered by Mrs. Maggs. "I think," said the director, "I should like my lunch now, if you please. They will give you lunch downstairs, Mrs. Studdock, something more substantial than mine. But if you will sit with me while I eat and drink, I will show you some of the amenities of our house." Mrs. Maggs presently returned with a tray, bearing a glass, a small flacon of red wine, and a roll of bread. She set it down on a table at the director's side and left the room. "You see," said the director, "I live like the king in Kurdi. It is a surprisingly pleasant diet." With these words, he broke the bread and poured himself out a glass of wine.
"I never read the book you are speaking of," said Jane.
They talked of the book a little while the director ate and drank, but presently he took up the plate and tipped the crumbs off onto the floor. "Now, Mrs. Studdock," he said, "you shall see a diversion, but you must be perfectly still." With these words, he took from his pocket a little silver whistle and blew a note on it. And Jane sat still till the room became filled with silence like a solid thing, and there was first a scratching and then a rustling, and presently she saw three plump mice working their passage across what was to them the thick undergrowth of the carpet, nosing this way and that, so that if their course had been drawn, it would have resembled that of a winding river, until they were so close that she could see the twinkling of their eyes and even the palpitation of their noses. In spite of what she had said, she did not really care for mice in the neighbourhood of her feet, and it was with an effort that she sat still. Thanks to this effort, she saw mice for the first time as they really are, not as creeping things, but as dainty quadrupeds, almost, when they sat up, like tiny kangaroos, with sensitive, kid-gloved forepaws and transparent ears. With quick, inaudible movements, they ranged to and fro till not a crumb was left on the floor. Then he blew a second time on his whistle, and with a sudden whisk of tails, all three of them were racing for home, and in a few seconds had disappeared behind the coal-box. The director looked at her with laughter in his eyes. "It is impossible," thought Jane, "to regard him as old." "There," he said, "a very simple adjustment. Humans want crumbs removed, mice are anxious to remove them. It ought never to have been a cause of war. But you see that obedience and rule are more like a dance than a drill, especially between man and woman, where the roles are always changing." "How huge we must seem to them," said Jane. This inconsequent remark had a very curious cause. Hugeness was what she was thinking of, and for one moment it had seemed she was thinking of her own hugeness in comparison with the mice. But almost at once this identification collapsed. She was really thinking simply of hugeness. Or rather, she was not thinking of it. She was, in some strange fashion, experiencing it. Something intolerably big, something from Brobdingnag, was pressing on her, was approaching, was almost in the room. She felt herself shrinking, suffocated, emptied of all power and virtue. She darted a glance at the director, which was really a cry for help, and that glance, in some inexplicable way, revealed him as being, like herself, a very small object. The whole room was a tiny place, a mouse's hole, and it seemed to her to be tilted aslant, as though the insupportable mass and splendour of this formless hugeness in approaching had knocked it askew. She heard the director's voice. "Quick," he said gently, "you must leave me now. This is no place for us small ones, but I am inured. Go." 3. When Jane left the hilltop village of St. Anne's and came down to the station, she found that, even down there, the fog had begun to lift. Great windows had opened in it, and as the train carried her on, it passed repeatedly through pools of afternoon sunlight. During this journey, she was so divided against herself that one might say there were three, if not four, Janes in the compartment. The first was a Jane simply receptive of the director, recalling every word and every look, and delighting in them. A Jane taken utterly off her guard, shaken out of the modest little outfit of contemporary ideas which had hitherto made her portion of wisdom, and swept away on the flood tide of an experience which she did not understand and could not control. For she was trying to control it. That was the function of the second Jane. This second Jane regarded the first with disgust, as the kind of woman, in fact, whom she had always particularly despised. Once, coming out of a cinema, she had heard a little shop girl say to her friend, "Oh, wasn't he lovely? If he'd looked at me the way he looked at her, I'd have followed him to the end of the world." A little tawdry, made-up girl sucking a peppermint. Whether the second Jane was right in equating the first Jane with that girl may be questioned, but she did, and she found her intolerable. To have surrendered without terms at the mere voice and look of this stranger, to have abandoned, without noticing it, that prim little grasp on her own destiny, that perpetual reservation which she thought essential to her status as a grown-up, integrated, intelligent person, the thing was utterly degrading, vulgar, uncivilized. The third Jane was a new and unexpected visitant. Of the first there had been traces in girlhood, and the second was what Jane took to be her real or normal self. But the third one, this moral Jane, was one whose existence she had never suspected. Risen from some unknown region of grace or heredity, it uttered all sorts of things which Jane had often heard before, but which had never, till that moment, seemed to be connected with real life. If it had simply told her that her feelings about the director were wrong, she would not have been very surprised, and would have discounted it as the voice of tradition. But it did not. It kept on blaming her for not having similar feelings about Mark. It kept on pressing into her mind those new feelings about Mark, feelings of guilt and pity which she had first experienced in the director's room. It was Mark who had made the fatal mistake. She must be nice to Mark. The director obviously insisted on it. At the very moment when her mind was most filled with another man, there arose, clouded with some undefined emotion, a resolution to give Mark much more than she had ever given him before, and a feeling that in doing so she would be really giving it to the director. And this produced in her such a confusion of sensations that the whole inner debate became indistinct and flowed over into the larger experience of the fourth Jane, who was Jane herself and dominated all the rest at every moment without effort and even without choice. This fourth and supreme Jane was simply in the state of joy. The other three had no power upon her, for she was in the sphere of Jove, amid light and music and festal pomp, brimmed with life and radiant in health, jocund and clothed in shining garments. She thought scarcely at all of the curious sensations which had immediately preceded the director's dismissal of her, and made that dismissal almost a relief. When she tried to, it immediately led her thoughts back to the director himself. Whatever she tried to think of led back to the director himself, and, in him, to joy. She saw from the windows of the train the outlined beams of sunlight pouring over stubble or burnished woods, and felt that they were like the notes of a trumpet. Her eyes rested on the rabbits and cows as they flitted by, and she embraced them in heart with merry holiday love. She delighted in the occasional speech of the one wizened old man who shared her compartment, and saw, as never before, the beauty of his shrewd and sunny old mind, sweet as a nut and English as a chalk down. She reflected with surprise how long it was since music had played any part in her life, and resolved to listen to many chorales by Bach on the gramophone that evening. Or else, perhaps, she would read a great many Shakespeare sonnets. She rejoiced also in her hunger and thirst, and decided that she would make herself buttered toast for tea, a great deal of buttered toast. And she rejoiced also in the consciousness of her own beauty, for she had the sensation, it may have been false in fact, but it had nothing to do with vanity, that it was growing and expanding like a magic flower with every minute that passed. In such a mood, it was only natural, after the old countryman had got out at Cure Hardy, to stand up and look at herself in the mirror which confronted her on the wall of the compartment. Certainly she was looking well. She was looking unusually well. And, once more, there was little vanity in this, for beauty was made for others. Her beauty belonged to the director. It belonged to him so completely that he could even decide not to keep it for himself, but to order that it be given to another, by an act of obedience lower, and therefore higher, more unconditional, and therefore more delighting, than if he had demanded it for himself. As the train came into Edgestow Station, Jane was just deciding that she would not try to get a bus. She would enjoy the walk up to Sandown. And then, what on earth was all this? The platform, usually almost deserted at this hour, was like a London platform on a bank holiday. "Here you are, mate," cried a voice as she opened the door, and half a dozen men crowded into her carriage so roughly that for a moment she could not get out. She found difficulty in crossing the platform. People seemed to be going in all directions at once, angry, rough, and excited people. "Get back into the train, quick!" shouted someone. "Get out of the station if you're not travelling," bawled another voice. "What the devil?" asked a third just beside her. And then a woman's voice said, oh dear, why don't they stop it?" And from outside, beyond the station, came a great roaring noise like the noise of a football crowd. There seemed to be a lot of unfamiliar lights about. Hours later, bruised, frightened, and tired to death, Jane found herself in a street she did not even know, surrounded by NICE policemen and a few of their females, the Wapes. Her course had been like that of a man trying to get home along the beach when the tide is coming in. She had been driven out of her natural route along Warwick Street. They were looting shops and making bonfires there, and forced to take a much wider circle up by the asylum, which would have brought her home in the end. Then even that wider circle had proved impracticable, for the same reason. She had been forced to try a still longer way round, and each time the tide had got there before her. Finally she had seen Bone Lane, straight and empty and still, and apparently her last chance of getting home that night at all. A couple of NICE police, one seemed to meet them everywhere except where the rioting was most violent, had shouted out, "You can't go down there, miss." But as they then turned their backs on her, and it was poorly lit, and because she was now desperate, Jane had made a bolt for it. They caught her. And that was how she found herself being taken into a lighted room and questioned by a uniformed woman with short grey hair, a square face, and an unlighted cheroot. The room was in disorder, as if a private house had been suddenly and roughly converted into a temporary police station. The woman with the cheroot took no particular interest until Jane had given her name. Then Miss Hardcastle looked her in the face for the first time, and Jane felt quite a new sensation. She was already tired and frightened, but this was different. The face of the other woman affected her as the face of some men, fat men with small greedy eyes and strange disquieting smiles, had affected her when she was in her teens. It was dreadfully quiet and yet dreadfully interested in her. And Jane saw that some quite new idea was dawning on the woman as she stared at her, some idea that the woman found attractive, then tried to put aside, and then returned to dally with, and then finally, with a little sigh of contentment, accepted. Miss Hardcastle lit her cheroot and blew a cloud of smoke towards her. If Jane had known how seldom Miss Hardcastle actually smoked, she would have been even more alarmed. The policemen and policewomen who surrounded her probably did. The whole atmosphere of the room became a little different. "Jane Studdock," said the fairy. "I know all about you, honey. You'll be the wife of my friend Mark." While she spoke, she was writing something on a green form. "That's all right," said Miss Hardcastle. "You'll be able to see hubby again now. We'll take you out to Bellbury tonight. Now just one question, dear. What were you doing down here at this time of night?"
"I had just come off a train."
"And where had you been, honey?"
Jane said nothing.
"You hadn't been getting up to mischief while hubby was away, had you?"
"Will you please let me go?" said Jane. "I want to get home. I am very tired, and it's very late."
"But you're not going home," said Miss Hardcastle. "You're coming out to Bellbury."
"My husband has said nothing about my joining him there."
Miss Hardcastle nodded. "That was one of his mistakes. But you're coming with us."
"What do you mean?"
"It's an arrest, honey," said Miss Hardcastle, holding out the piece of green paper on which she had been writing. It appeared to Jane, as all official forms always appeared, a mass of compartments, some empty, some full of small print, some scrawled with signatures in pencil, and one bearing her own name, all meaningless.
"Oh!" screamed Jane suddenly, overcome with a sensation of nightmare, and made a dash for the door. Of course she never reached it. A moment later she came to her senses and found herself held by the two policewomen.
"What a naughty temper," said Miss Hardcastle playfully. "But we'll put the nasty men outside, shall we?" She said something, and the policemen removed themselves and shut the door behind them. As soon as they were gone, Jane felt that a protection had been withdrawn from her. "Well," said Miss Hardcastle, addressing the two uniformed girls, "let's see. 12:45, and all going nicely. I think, Daisy, we can afford ourselves a little stand-easy. Be careful, Kitty. Make your top grip under her shoulder just a little tighter. That's right." While she was speaking, Miss Hardcastle was undoing her belt, and when she had finished, she removed her tunic and flung it on the sofa, revealing a huge torso, uncorseted, as Bill the Blizzard had complained, rank, floppy, and thinly clad, such things as Rubens might have painted in delirium. Then she resumed her seat, removed the cheroot from her mouth, blew another cloud of smoke in Jane's direction, and addressed her.
"Where had you been by that train?" she said.
And Jane said nothing, partly because she could not speak, and partly because she knew now beyond all doubt that these were the enemies of the human race whom the director was fighting against, and one must tell them nothing. She did not feel heroic in making this decision. The whole scene was becoming unreal to her, and it was as if between sleeping and waking that she heard Miss Hardcastle say, "I think, Kitty dear, you and Daisy had better bring her round here." And it was still only half real when the two women forced her round to the other side of the table, and she saw Miss Hardcastle sitting with her legs wide apart and settling herself in the chair as if in the saddle, long leather-clad legs projecting from beneath her short skirt. The women forced her on with a skilled, quiet increase of pressure whenever she resisted, until she stood between Miss Hardcastle's feet, whereupon Miss Hardcastle brought her feet together so that she had Jane's ankles pinioned between her own. This proximity to the ogress affected Jane with such horror that she had no fears left for what they might be going to do with her. And for what seemed an endless time, Miss Hardcastle stared at her, smiling a little and blowing smoke in her face.
"Do you know," said Miss Hardcastle at last, "you're rather a pretty little thing in your way."
There was another silence.
"Where had you been by that train?" said Miss Hardcastle.
And Jane stared as if her eyes would start out of her head, and said nothing. Then suddenly Miss Hardcastle leant forward, and, after very carefully turning down the edge of Jane's dress, thrust the lighted end of the cheroot against her shoulder. After that there was another pause and another silence.
"Where had you been by that train?" said Miss Hardcastle. How many times this happened, Jane could never remember, but somehow or other there came a time when Miss Hardcastle was talking not to her, but to one of the women. "What are you fussing about, Daisy?" she was saying.
"I was only saying, ma'am, it was 1:05.
"How time flies, doesn't it, Daisy? But what if it is? Aren't you comfortable, Daisy? You're not getting tired holding a little bit of a thing like her."
"Oh, no, ma'am, thank you. But you did say, ma'am, you'd meet Captain O'Hara of 1 sharp.
"Captain O'Hara?" said Miss Castle, dreamily at first, and then louder, like one waking from a dream. Next moment she had jumped up and was putting on her tunic. "Bless the girl," she said. "What a pair of blockheads you are! Why didn't you remind me before?"
"Well, ma'am, I didn't exactly like to."
"Like to? What do you think you're there for?"
"Well, you don't like us to interrupt, ma'am, sometimes, when you're examining," said the girl sulkily.
"Don't argue," shouted Miss Hardcastle, wheeling round and hitting her cheek a resounding blow with the palm of her hand. "Look sharp. Get the prisoner into the car. Don't wait to button up her dress, idiots. I'll be after you the moment I've dipped my face in cold water." A few seconds later, pinioned between Daisy and Kitty, but still close to Miss Hardcastle, there seemed to be room for 5 in the back of the car, Jane found herself gliding through the darkness. "Better go through the town as little as possible, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle's voice. "It'll be pretty lively by now. Go on to the asylum and work down those little streets at the back of the close." There seemed to be all sorts of strange noises and lights about. At places, too, there seemed to be a great many people. Then there came a moment when Jane found that the car had drawn up. "What the hell are you stopping for?" said Miss Hardcastle. For a second or two there was no answer from the driver except grunts and the noise of unsuccessful attempts to start up the engine. "What's the matter?" repeated Miss Hardcastle sharply. "Dunno, ma'am," said the driver, still working away. "God," said Miss Hardcastle, "can't you even look after a car? Some of you people want a little humane remedial treatment yourselves." The street in which they were was empty, but, to judge by the noise, it was near some other street which was very full and very angry. The man got out, swearing under his breath, and opened the bonnet of the car. "Here," said Miss Hardcastle, "you two hop out. Look round for another car, anywhere within 5 minutes' walk. Commandeer it. If you don't find one, be back here in 10 minutes, whatever happens. Sharp!" The other two policemen alighted and disappeared at the double. Miss Hardcastle continued pouring abuse on the driver, and the driver continued working at the engine. The noise grew louder. Suddenly the driver straightened himself and turned his face. Jane saw the sweat shining on it in the lamplight towards Miss Hardcastle. "Look here, miss," he said. "That's about enough, see? You keep a civil tongue in your head, or else come and mend a bloody car yourself if you're so bloody clever."
"Don't you try taking that line with me, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle, "or you'll find me saying a little word about you to the ordinary police."
"Well, suppose you do," said Joe. "I'm beginning to think I might as well be in clinkers in your bucking tea party. Struth, I've been in the military police, and I've been in the black and tans, and I've been in the BUF, but they were all ruddy picnics to this lot. A man got some decent treatment there, and he had men over him, not a bloody lot of old women."
"Yes, Joe," said Miss Hardcastle, "but it wouldn't be clink for you this time if I passed the word to the ordinary cops."
"Oh, it wouldn't it? I might have a story or two to tell about yourself if it came to that."
"For the Lord's sake, speak to him nicely, ma'am," wailed Kitty. "They're coming. We'll catch it proper."
And in fact, men running by 2s and 3s had begun to trickle into the street. "Foot it, girls," said Miss Hardcastle. "Sharp's the word. This way." Jane found herself hustled out of the car and hurried along between Daisy and Kitty. Miss Hardcastle moved in front. The little party darted across the street and up an alley on the far side.
"Any of you know the way here?" asked Miss Hardcastle, when they had walked a few steps.
"Don't know, I'm sure, ma'am," said Daisy. "I'm a stranger here myself, ma'am," said Kitty.
"Nice useful lot I've got," said Miss Hardcastle. "Is there anything you do know?"
"It doesn't seem to go no further, ma'am," said Kitty.
The alley had indeed turned out to be a dead end. Miss Hardcastle stood still for a moment. Unlike her subordinates, she did not seem to be frightened, but only pleasantly excited, and rather amused at the white faces and shaky voices of the girls.
"Well," she said, "this is what I call a night out. You're seeing life, Daisy, aren't you? I wonder, are any of these houses empty? All locked, anyway. Perhaps we'd best stay where we are."
The shouting in the street they had left had grown louder, and they could see a confused mass of humanity surging vaguely in a westward direction. Suddenly it became much louder still and angrier. "They've caught Joe," said Miss Hardcastle. "If he can make himself heard, he'll send them up here. Blast! This means losing the prisoner. Oh, stop blubbering, Daisy, you little fool. Quick, we must go down into the crowd separately. We've a very good chance of getting through. Keep your heads. Don't shoot, whatever you do. Try to get to Billingham at the crossroads. Ta-ta, Babs. The quieter you keep, the less likely we are to meet again." Miss Hardcastle set off at once. Jane saw her stand for a few seconds on the fringes of the crowd and then disappear into it. The two girls hesitated and then followed. Jane sat down on a doorstep. The burns were painful where her dress had rubbed against them, but what chiefly troubled her was extreme weariness. She was also deadly cold and a little sick, but above all tired. So tired she could drop asleep almost. She shook herself. There was complete silence all about her. She was colder than she had ever been before, and her limbs ached. "I believe I have been asleep," she thought. She rose, stretched herself, and walked down the desolate lamplit alley into the larger street. It was quite empty, except for one man in a railway uniform who said, "Good morning, miss," as he walked smartly past. She stood for a moment, undecided, and then began to walk slowly to her right. She put her hand in the pocket of the coat which Daisy and Kitty had flung round her before leaving the flat, and found 3/4 of a large slab of chocolate. She was ravenous, and began munching it. Just as she finished, she was overtaken by a car, which drew up shortly after it had passed her. "Are you all right?" said a man, poking his head out.
"Were you hurt in the riot?" said a woman's voice from within. "No, not much. I don't know," said Jane stupidly.
The man stared at her and then got out.
"I say," he said, "you don't look too good. Are you sure you're quite well?"
Then he turned and spoke to the woman inside. It seemed so long to Jane since she had heard kind or even sane voices that she felt like crying. The unknown couple made her sit in the car and gave her brandy and after that sandwiches. Finally, they asked if they could give her a lift home. Where was home? And Jane, somewhat to her surprise, heard her own voice very sleepily answering, "The Manor at St. Anne's."
"Oh, that's fine," said the man. "We're making for Birmingham, and we have to pass it."
Then Jane fell asleep at once again, and awoke only to find herself entering a lighted doorway and being received by a woman in pyjamas and an overcoat who turned out to be Mrs. Maggs. But she was too tired to remember how or where she got to bed.